And now for something completely different.
This is the Morrow Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Let's do it.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. With you till 3 on this Thursday. We look ahead towards the weekend. Coming up, the Celtics take a 2-1 lead in the NBA Finals. Plus, who's the second best coach in college football? Who are the best coaches in the NFL? Talk about that coming up. A punishment levied for the golfers that have joined the LIV Golf Tour as they get off and rolling. Who are the top quarterbacks in next year's draft class? And one unique, maybe even weird anecdote about one of them. Plus, we'll talk about athletes and their traditions, if you will. Aaron Rodgers has a new girlfriend. We got to talk about that, of course, and a whole lot more throughout the afternoon. We'll catch up with a member of the Charleston Battery later on this afternoon, give away some battery tickets, too, and whatever else comes up between now and 3 o'clock. You can join the conversation throughout the afternoon, 843-721-9500 to give us a call. You can always text the show, 843-608-1734. Get to us on Twitter at Morrow Middays, on Facebook at ESPN Charleston, via email studio at kirkmanbroadcasting.com, or online at charlestonsportsradio.com. Head over there and click on our show page where you can leave a comment for the show. You can find the latest versions of the show podcasted right there, or you can even take the Morrow Midday Show with you wherever you go. Just simply stream us online at charlestonsportsradio.com. With you till 3 on this Thursday. Trent's on the steel wheels. Trent, what's going on? How are you?
Luke, I'm doing well on this Thursday. It's a nice day here in the low country. Pretty hot. Great basketball last night. Good game. Some back and forth. It was fun to watch. We've got, you know, war breaking out in the golf world. What better Thursday could we be on right now here on the Morrow Midday Show?
It's true. Let's start with the NBA. We'll get to the golf stuff a little bit later on. Everything else going on throughout the afternoon. But game 3 of the NBA Finals last night, and the Celtics take the lead in the series with a big win last night. A couple of things that stand out. For one, it's this whole zigzag theory that's been going on throughout the playoffs. Celtics played lousy in Game 2. As expected, they played much better in Game 3. They didn't turn the ball over nearly as much, and that's been the difference in their results this year. When the Celtics turn the basketball over fewer than 15 times, they're almost undefeated. But they've lost almost every time they've turned it over more than 15 times. It's pretty simple. And last night, on their home floor, good environment, crowd into it. First finals game in Boston in over a decade. The Celtics played much better, took care of the basketball. Right, Tatum played well enough and got enough help from the supporting cast. Role players usually play better at home than on the road. And the return home last night, we saw a little bit of a return of Al Horford. Jaylen Brown was really good. Marcus Smart played well. Really, the whole team chipped in. And on the Warriors' side, Golden State needs usually like three things in order to win. You need Steph Curry, and he's been consistent. I think Steph Curry still has been the best player in the NBA Finals. Then you need a little help, and they got a little bit last night with Klay Thompson, though nobody else really stepped up. Klay played his best game of the series. And then you need some physicality, some defense, which is what Draymond Green brings to the table. And last night, maybe he was a little too physical. And the defense for the Warriors was not good enough. They got beat on the glass. They got beat on second chances. They got beat on points in the paint. I actually thought the Warriors should have played more Looney and probably less Draymond Green before he eventually fouled out. But the Celtics beat him up inside. They had too much size. They were more physical than the Warriors, and the Celtics get the win. Now, I'm not surprised. I told you on the show yesterday the Celtics would win, and I said, you know, take them to cover. You might as well. Teams that win have been winning by, as we saw last night again, double digits. But while I thought the Celtics would win last night, I still think the Warriors win the series. So I'm not all that surprised about what happened last night. I figured Boston would come out with a much better effort. They haven't lost back-to-back games all postseason. They were at home. They weren't going to turn it over as much as they did in Game 2. And now I think the Warriors will bounce back in Game 4 tomorrow night. Granted, if Steph Curry is healthy. More on that in just a moment. Curry is banged up, not 100%, or even can't play somehow, then the Warriors are doomed. But the Celtics take that 2-1 lead. And I think, you know, a lot of people are pointing the finger at Draymond Green today. And I do think it's actually kind of fair. Here was Marcus Smart. This was actually before the game yesterday. But it's fitting now that you listen back to it after the game. Because a lot was made about Draymond Green, how he acted or played in Game 2. And the Celtics, how are they going to respond? Well, they responded just fine. And here was their thought process going in, as Marcus Smart said before the game last night.
You respond to fire with fire, right? I mean, we just got to, you know, turn around and do the same thing. You know, if he's going to come in here and try to be physical, this is our house and we got to protect it. I mean, as any competitor would tell you, you know, when you get hit in the mouth like that, it's only one way to respond. And if you're not really ready to do that, then you don't need to be on the stage. And this is a stage where it's going to take, you know, we got to be willing to risk it all out there for your team and for the victory. So by all means necessary, that's the mindset that they have. It's the mindset we have, but we got to go out there and execute it.
Marcus Smart before the game last night, and then I thought they did go out there and execute it. Draymond Green's antics in Game 2 were a problem for Boston. In Game 3, they were a problem for Golden State. He was a net negative out there last night. And it's one thing when you're on your home floor, as they were in Game 2 in Golden State, and you have these young Celtics. And maybe after they won Game 1, as we've seen throughout this postseason, they seem to alternate good performances. They're not consistent enough. They're still young. It's their first NBA Finals. And after winning Game 1 on the road, maybe a little big for their britches, and that was a bit of a reality check in Game 2. Right? As I always say, it's like when you're beating up on some of the buddies and pick up hoops outside and you're feeling pretty good, and then you challenge either your older brother or maybe your old man, and he puts you in your place. He says, right, you're not ready to beat me just yet. A little bit of a reality check, and that was Game 2. And the Celtics looked maybe a little overwhelmed on the road, hostile environment. Right? The Warriors were beating them up. And the Celtics, young team in that spot, a little frazzled. Not so much last night on their home floor. A little bit different. Game 3, they're in their area of comfort. They have the crowd behind them chanting F Draymond Green. And it didn't get them all worked up as much last night as it did Game 2. But as Marcus Smart said, you fight fire with fire. Now, in the real world, I don't know if that really does work out. I don't know if there's a fire, if you should fight it with a fire. I don't know how that would work. But in the case of the NBA Finals, I thought it worked pretty well. I always reference the movie Death Sentence because it was filmed in South Carolina, so I feel like I have more of a reason to bring it up. And also because it's such an underrated movie, and I love that movie with Kevin Bacon. But I always love, spoiler alert, and the movie's 15 years old. By the end of the film, right, Kevin Bacon's trying to seek revenge on a gang. And by the end of the film, he becomes exactly like one of the gang members. And he's sitting there in the final scene with the head of this gang he was battling with. And as that guy's dying, he's laughing. And Kevin Bacon says, like, what are you laughing about? And he says, right, I've turned you into exactly what you hated. And it's similar in these playoffs. We saw it when the Warriors went up against the Grizzlies. And we talked about it at the same time. And I used my death sentence reference then as well. But it was a similar idea. Draymond Green trying to impose himself and that physicality on a young team to try to intimidate, at the time, the Memphis Grizzlies. And it worked at first, but then the Grizzlies fought fire with fire. They decided or realized we're going to have to swing back, and they did. Now, the Warriors ended up winning that series. I still think they win this series as well, but similar here. The Celtics said, we're not going to take this lying down. They're going to come out and swing. And so in that Grizzlies series, it led to Gary Payton II getting injured and missing the rest of that series in the next. And in this series, maybe, we'll see what happens, but it led to Steph Curry at least getting banged up last night, if not getting injured. And there was nothing dirty about that play with Al Horford, but it's just the idea that when you ramp up the intensity, the other team, again, fighting fire with fire, is going to match that. And now guys are diving after a loose ball, and they're getting more physical, and the game becomes more chippy, and you land on Steph Curry, and you hurt his ankle or whatever it is. And we'll see what type of Steph Curry we get in game four. It's like when you go out to the bar with some buddies and you have that one friend that whenever he drinks, maybe he becomes a little belligerent and he's like picking fights with people or he's just talking trash. And you're saying like, come on, we're just trying to have a good time. And then just because you're there, you're the innocent bystander, you're the one that gets punched in the face. And like, come on, right? You get all pissed off at your buddy. He had to bring it to another level. You weren't doing anything. You just happened to be there having a good night. And one of the guys he's talking trash to ends up punching you in the face. Like Gary Payton Jr. or Gary Payton II. Right? Draymond Green is ramping up the intensity of the series. Gary Payton Jr. is the one that takes the blow. Last night, Draymond Green being a pest as he has all series, Steph Curry is the one that takes the shrapnel. And if he's not 100% for game four moving forward, not only will last night be on Draymond Green because he was a net negative out there, this whole series will fall on the shoulders of Draymond. Here was former NBA player Isaiah Thomas on NBA TV last night after the game, talking about Draymond's performance and how, whether it's the podcast, whether it's the war of words, whether it's just trying to be a pest out there, Draymond seems distracted. Here was Isaiah Thomas last night.
You play 34 minutes. You have 4 rebounds, 3 assists, and 2 points. Draymond Green does that in a grade school game, not in the NBA Finals. So when you talk about focus, this is what the NBA Finals is about. And right now, he has lost focus in terms of concentrating on beating the opponent. He's not talking about Jaylen Brown. He's not talking about Tatum. He's not talking about Marcus Smart. He's talking about podcasts, and he's talking about Cedric Maxwell and the fans. Concentration needs to come back on the Boston Celtics players who you're playing against out on the floor.
You really think that the comments...
100%.
Isaiah Thomas after the game last night. And, of course, Isaiah played with the Bad Boy Pistons, Rick Mahorn and Bill Laimbeer, who were maybe the earlier versions of Draymond Green, just without social media and podcasts, but would go out there and back it up. So point being, Isaiah kind of knows what it's like to play alongside a bit of a, if you want to say, a bully, a physical player out on the court, a mauler. And Draymond grew up as fans of those teams in that area and maybe also styled his game similar to the Bad Boy Pistons. But he was bad last night. Now, a few numbers that stand out. In the final minutes of the first half, he had zeros across his stat line. Nothing until the final minutes of the first half. Right? He was just getting his wind sprints in out there for about 2 quarters. No points, no rebounds, no assists, no blocks, nothing in the stat line for almost the entirety of the first half. And it was also the first time in his playoff career that Draymond Green had a combination of less than 10 when you total up his points, rebounds, and assists. Still couldn't reach double digits. In fact, throughout this postseason, Draymond Green has had 14 games in the playoffs in which he either had double-digit points, assists, or rebounds. One of the three. It's happened 14 times. He has also recorded 17 podcast episodes during the playoffs. Now, you could do those other things. I'm not telling you as an athlete, right? You can't have outside interests or a way to come down after a game or just to the ability to express yourself. But I've said the same thing about Baker Mayfield and any other athlete, right? When you want to create a lot of noise around yourself and then you don't really go out there and back it up, that's where the problem becomes. Nobody cares if, say, LeBron James is talking trash as he plays in 9 straight NBA finals. It's like, yeah, you know what? He could record podcasts. It's working. He could record podcasts. He could pick fights with old players. Whatever. He keeps getting back to the NBA finals and doing so by leading the team there, scoring 30 points. Right? When Baker Mayfield has the Browns in the playoffs and they are in the playoffs for the first time in years, okay, yeah, you could get away with the commercials and maybe being a little obnoxious and right, calling out teammates or the training staff or whatever it may be. But when you're Draymond Green and you're not contributing much to the table, then you give people a reason to point to those things and say those are now a distraction. That's now the issue. That's what's keeping Draymond back. And whether that's the case or not, I don't know. It's just a bad look. When you are spending your time during the week recording podcasts, picking fights with Cedric Maxwell, talking about how these Celtics players aren't that good. Oh, Al Horford, right? He can't play that. He won't shoot that well. Well, now you're down 2-1 in the series, and you really haven't done much yourself last night to help. Kendrick Perkins was on Get Up this morning, And he said the series is over. The Celtics have gone up 2-1, and they have this thing won. Here is Perk this morning.
Yeah, they done. Look, I told people before the series that the Celtics were going to win this in seven. But after watching them last night and watching their intensity, their defensive prowess, see, we keep talking about shot making. I don't know how many times I got to come on here and keep preaching to everybody. Yes, offense will win you games. Defense win you championships. And when you look at the perimeter defenders that the Celtics have, yes, we know about Marcus Smart, the defensive player of the year. But they have Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown, and Grant Williams. Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown alone would be a number one defender on the perimeter on another team. And then you have Robert Williams being able to, you know, bring what he brought to the table last night, four blocks, all turn the rim and things to that nature. Big Al Horford doing what he do. Again, I'm going to repeat, because I'm at Harvard, I'm dropping knowledge as a former champion, a guy that went to five NBA finals. Offense win games, defense win championships.
Kendrick Perkins this morning thinking that the Celtics have it wrapped up. They had played better defense last night. They were able to take the blows and even the mind games from Golden State and respond with even more physicality. Right, Robert Williams was fantastic. He may be the difference maker in this whole series. But I don't think the series is over just yet. Now, there's a caveat to that. If you tell me Steph Curry's not 100%, he's not going to look right when he plays game four tomorrow, okay, then I'd probably agree, yeah, series is over. But if you tell me Curry's just fine, he'll be 100% tomorrow moving forward, I think the Warriors bounce back and win tomorrow, and that's all they needed to do in Boston. Just split these games. And you head back to Golden State in what becomes a three-game series, and you're home for two of the last three games. Everybody always freaks out to each and every game of the NBA. And part of it, it's kind of just a hazard of the industry that we need to come on the air here the next day, and we have to come up with big takeaways and big storylines and fill airtime, and they'll do it on TV all day long as well, so we can all overreact to these games. And it seems like every time we have an NBA Finals game or you have a game in the NHL playoffs, anytime there's a series, maybe even Major League Baseball, whoever wins the last game, we think they're the winner. Celtics win game one of the finals, oh, they're winning this thing. Then the Warriors come back and it's like, oh, hold on, wait a minute. It was just that fourth quarter for Boston. The Warriors, they'll be just fine. Then the Celtics win last night. Oh, yep, it's over. Celtics are going to win. And I tell you, if the Warriors win tomorrow and even it up at two going back to Golden State, the talk over the weekend will be, oh, hold on. The Warriors are just fine. They're going to win this series. It's what we always do. So I'm not going to overreact to last night or anything we've seen so far. I told you on the air yesterday, the Celtics will win game three. They did. I still think the Warriors win the series. That remains to be seen. I think Golden State wins tomorrow. I think they even the series. They'll be heading back to Golden State tied at two. Wouldn't be surprised if they win game five, even though Boston has not lost back-to-back games. And we'll see what happens the rest of the way. But to me, this series is still far from over unless you tell me Curry is banged up, not 100%. This is a young Boston team. There's a reason why they're so inconsistent. There's a reason why they seem to have one good game and then a bad game. Last night was their good game. I think they come out in game four and don't play as well on their home floor tomorrow and the Warriors even the series. But I'll say this, credit to Boston last night for they took the blows, like Frank Sinatra in My Way, right? They took the blows from Golden State in the third quarter. Once again, the Warriors played great in the third quarter like they do every night. And yet the Celtics came right back in the fourth quarter. It's almost like there's a right? They're in a trance in the third. It's amazing how the Warriors, the third quarter, if you separate that third quarter, it's so different from the rest of the quarters of the game. I don't get it. Because as soon as the fourth quarter comes, it's like, all right, back to normal. You snapped out of it. And as soon as the fourth quarter came last night, the Celtics opened up, on a 9-2 run and built the lead back to double digits. It's so weird. You know, it's almost like a mental head game. Like, let's just get to the fourth. And then once you get into the fourth quarter, nothing really changes from a basketball perspective. And yet, they get to the fourth quarter, the Celtics play much better. And they come out in the fourth. Okay, good. It's the fourth quarter. We could get back to playing good basketball. And they start that quarter on that run, and they build the lead back up to the double digits, and the Warriors were terrible again in the fourth quarter last night, especially down the stretch. So credit to Boston. For now, they've outplayed Golden State in two of the three fourth quarters, and that's why they lead the series 2-1. But you still have to figure out that third quarter. We can give all the credit in the world to Boston and the coaching job, but how you continue to get outplayed in game three of every game seems weird, right? That's the one negative. That's the one thing you can critique for Boston. As good of a coaching job as Ime Udoka's done, as good as they've played to get up 2-1, there's still something about that third quarter that they just can't do well with. I think the Warriors win game 4 tomorrow, even the series, and we're far from done. But we'll see. It was a good win for the Celtics last night at home, and I thought Draymond Green did more negative than good for his team. I think he got caught up a little bit in all of this machismo, head games, trying to get the Celtics out of their element when really I thought he kind of got out of his own element. Maybe he took it a little too far, and the Celtics were able to handle it just fine in the win last night. When we come back, who's the second best coach in college football? I'd like to think we can all agree that Saban's still number one. Has there been a change behind him? Because Paul Feinbaum thinks so. It's the Moore Midday Show, right here on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
Diane's debutante backseat of Jackie's car. Sucking on chili dog, outside taste freeze. Diane sitting on Jackie's lap, got his hands between his knees. Jackie say, hey Diane, let's run off behind the shady trees. Dribble off those Bobby Brooks, let me do what I please. Say, oh yeah, life goes on. Long after the
coming up, who's the second best coach in college football? The Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow here on ESPN Radio. Plus the top coaches in the NFL, because there was quite the list that was put out by one football publication. We'll get to that coming up. Hey, we open the show talking about the NBA Finals and the Celtics taking the lead last night by winning Game 3. Did you see that before the game, the rim was a little too high for the Warriors warming up by about 2 inches? And the Warriors players knew, they realized, or they thought, like, something seems off. This rim seems a little too high. Now, I use that excuse, too, when I'm, you know, when I'm not making my shots. Wait a minute. You know, I'm out at the local park. Is this regulation? Is this rim? This hoop seems too high. Is this 10 feet? But the Warriors last night were correct. They brought out that little tape measure. They have a 10-foot pole. They borrowed it from the Grinch, and they hung it on the rim. And you saw it was still dangling from the floor. It was 2 inches too high, the rim was. So they had to correct it. Now, Trent, I ask you. Was this just a coincidence? Was this the Celtics' version of Deflategate? Or was it even just for warm-up, some sort of mental head game for Golden State? What did you think of the rim being too high on one end of the floor before the game last night?
You know, Luke, I like to launch a lot of investigations,
right,
obviously, in the NHL playoffs, even in the NFL sometimes. I'm a big investigation guy, and I think the Corville Athletic Commission will launch a full investigation into what the Boston Celtics were truly trying to do. It seemed about, what, an inch and a half, 2 inches too high? That's incredibly important for an NBA game. This is the NBA Finals, TD Garden. We need to sit down with the staff and interrogate them to see who did this, who was behind this, who was the mastermind trying to throw off the Golden State Warriors.
Yeah, I agree. Now, people say, well, they both shoot on both ends of the floor. Maybe they were going to correct it before the game even started, or maybe after the first quarter, after the Warriors shot on that rim. Or maybe that'd be the rim that the Warriors would have to shoot on in the fourth quarter. So even if you both shot on two quarters, right, by the time you get to the fourth, the Warriors are shooting on a rim that's too high. From now on, you got to check this thing before the players come out for warmups. Get your little 10-foot pole, hook it on the rim. It takes 2 seconds. And let's check these rims before the players even come out for warmups. As they're getting this thing set up, the rims and the floor, they put down the floor during the day or maybe the day before, whatever it is. Right, before they come out in the court now, I guess you could still change it in the meantime. But and this should be checked before the players even get out there for warmups. And the Warriors, credit to them, they knew something was off. The rim seems too high, and it sure was. Like, even if you just do it for warm-ups, you have them warm up on a 10-foot, 2-inch hoop, and then you get to the game, and if they adjust it to the proper height, still, that could throw you out of whack.
Do you think Steph Curry, like, went up for a dunk or something in pregame, and he missed heavily and realized that, oh, wait, this is a little off? Because he can get there. He can get there, but, it, you know, it takes a lot from Steph and those old legs
Right. Yeah, that was always my trick when I couldn't even grab the net. Hold on. Did you raise the rim on me?
Is this regulation? Yeah. Somebody come out here and measure, please.
Back in the day, right, when you used to have the hoop in the driveway, if you grew up, you had a fancy enough rim. Well, actually, some of them are real crappy, but you could adjust them. And, of course, my buddies and I, we played a lot of driveway basketball, and usually we would lower the rim to probably 9.5 just so we could dunk. Who doesn't do that? Right? That's the whole fun of basketball. So the Celtics, the Warriors came out, and they raised it up about 2 inches last night. And I saw a video, too, of Curry. Somebody on Twitter had put out a video, and like, look at Curry knocking down all these shots. So he was still, you know, warm-up shooting just fine. But every inch matters, makes a difference. Hey, earlier this week, Bill Bender, we've had on the show before, he put out a list of the best coaches in college football. So he went on the Feinbaum show on Tuesday, and they talked about it. Now, Nick Saban is still number one. I'd like to think we can all agree there. Saban is the best coach in college football, and I think he's the best coach all time in college football. The debate, apparently, comes down to number two. Now, Bill Bender has Dabo at number two, which would have been the case a year ago and beyond and hasn't changed. Feinbaum did not like this. Now, I didn't grab the audio, but I have the quotes for you. That in regards to Dabo being number two, Kirby Smart being number three, Feinbaum said, quote, "Are you telling me that Kirby Smart is inferior right now, even by one number, to Dabo Sweeney, in spite of that recent championship? I don't need to remind you, but look at the trajectory of the programs right now and where they are." He continued and said, "I think Dabo is yesterday's news. Kirby Smart is where it's at in college football today. Kirby Smart's a better coach than Dabo, and I don't care how many national championships he has. I'm saying it right now." That's what Feinbaum said in regards to this ranking. Now, it depends what we're talking about. If you're trying to power rank, like, the future of these coaches, who do you think are going to be the most successful moving forward? Or maybe if you wanted to, it's you know, it's your opinion. It wouldn't be the opinion I'd have, but if you were ranking like the 10 coaches you would want to have running your program, I would still have Dabo ahead of Kirby. But maybe there we could get into a debate. But if we're talking about past success, if we're comparing resumes and we're saying, okay, who's been the second best coach in college football? I think for Feinbaum, it's a lot of recency bias. Of course, there's a lot of SEC bias. We know that. When's the last time he said anything good about Clemson or the ACC? And I'm not a Clemson guy. I'm not an ACC fan. I'm not even an SEC fan. I'm neutral in all this. We just keep it real around here. I think it's recency bias to say, right, just based off of that national championship a year ago, that now Kirby should be ahead of Dabo that easily. Because Dabo has more national championships at a program in which he built up. He did not take over a Georgia that was already a top-tier program in the best conference in college football. Dabo took over a program that was not as good of a spot as Georgia was when Kirby got there. Dabo took over a program that historically was not as good, doesn't have the same tradition. And I would say at the time when they were both hired, certainly Clemson was not as easy of a job as Georgia. And I would also say, with all of that said, despite having the harder job, Dabo's won more national championships. And that's the most important. Feinbaum said in his explanation, "I don't care about national championships." That's kind of what you're graded on, though. Right? That's kind of the biggest part. I'm not going to tell you that, I don't know, bring it to the NFL. Like Andy Reid, I can't tell you Andy Reid's a better coach than Bill Belichick. Just compare Super Bowls. And I know that's a larger gap. We're talking here the difference between one. Dabo has only one more championship than Kirby. But there's not a lot of coaches who have won multiple national championships, let alone have done the job that Dabo did by building up that program to the point where they were beating an Alabama, which, by the way, was something for a number of years Kirby Smart couldn't do. Dabo did it before Kirby, while Kirby was in a better position to try to get past Alabama. So just because Georgia finally got over that hump and won a national championship this past year does not suddenly leapfrog Kirby ahead of Dabo. And also, let's not act like it's some sort of slight to put Kirby Smart at number three as the third best coach in college football. But I don't think he's past Dabo just yet. And if you want to look at the recent history, last 3 years, while it seems that Clemson has fallen off a little bit in the last 12 months, and I would tell you I am concerned about the immediate future of Clemson. It's why off the top I said it depends what we're talking about here with the rankings. Right? If you're telling me that Feinbaum, he's looking at it more for the future, all right, we could have an argument. Sure. I'm more concerned about Clemson's immediate future than Georgia. Absolutely. But in the past, Dabo has more national championship titles and last 3 years. If you want to look at the real recent past, since that's what we're talking about, Kirby just won a national championship. Last 3 years, both programs have 34 wins. They had the same record last 3 years. Now you want to say, well, one's in the SEC, one's in the ACC. That is fair. But it's also fair to point out that Clemson always has one of the best records against ranked teams and one of the best records against SEC teams. They've been just fine when they go up against that competition, at least outside of the playoff the last couple years. But Clemson has held their own against the top programs under Dabo Swinney. Now, I do agree, right? Moving forward, I would feel better about Georgia right now, of course. They just won. They're the defending national champs. Of course, I should feel better about Georgia right now than Clemson. But when I look at a list, maybe I'm interpreting it incorrectly, although I am in agreement with the guy who made the list, Bill Bender. When I think of one of these lists, when we were to do one of these lists, I'm looking at the past, not the future. Now, if that's the context you add, all right, give me your top 10 coaches for the next 10 years. That's a different conversation. But if you're ranking who are the best coaches in college football, I can only go off of what you accomplished. I'm not trying to predict the future. I can't. But basing it off the past, what we've seen from these coaches, I think Dabo's still number two. Saban is clearly number one, regardless of what may have happened last year against Kirby or in the national championship. I don't care. And I think Dabo's number two. And if you want to bump up Kirby just because of that national title and talk about the recent history, in that case, wouldn't you also bump him up ahead of Saban then for recent history? Because Kirby just beat Saban in the biggest game of the year. I think Saban's one, Dabo's two. If you want to put Kirby at number three, fine with me. But just because he finally won a national championship, I don't think that's enough. I don't think, you know, as the wind blows, we should be updating these things so quickly. Like, oh, hold on, wait a minute, forget all the other years. Kirby just won a national championship. He's the better coach than Dabo. I think Dabo has the longer track record. And up until that win, that one win, and it's a big win, but that one game out of a long career, that one game in the national championship this past year, instead we were talking about Kirby kind of being, for lack of a better term, a bit of a choke artist, right? Unable to win that big game. Unable to beat Alabama, to get over the hump with the talent that he's had there. I still think Dabo's number two. Where I do agree with Feinbaum is moving forward. I do feel better about Kirby, and if we were to update this list in, say, 5 years, maybe I'd change my mind in the next couple years. Maybe 12 months from now, I'm changing my mind. But as we sit here today, when this list was put out this week, yeah, I think Dabo's still number two. He has not lost that spot to Kirby Smart, despite Kirby finally getting a national championship. All right, congrats. You won a national championship. Now you got to get a second one. Because that's what Dabo did. Right, as impressive as it was that Kirby finally got that ring, okay, go try to win a second trophy. Because that's what Dabo did. Let's not minimize winning national championships. Just like when you look at coaches in the NFL, Major League, whoever, right? Pick any sport. To say that a coach that maybe has never won, right? Oh, he just never had the players. He was a better coach. Well, it's about winning. And it's about winning championships. So it's hard to write off a guy who has had won more championships and did so by taking over a program that was in a much different spot than when Kirby got to Georgia. Mark Richt at least had them, you know, it's kind of why he lost his job. They're on the doorstep. And then Kirby continued that tradition for a while before finally getting clearing that hurdle this past year. But Dabo still has the better track record in the past. In the future, maybe not so much. But all I can go off of is your resume, what you've done so far. And I think Dabo winning two at Clemson is more impressive than Kirby winning one at Georgia. Even if he has to battle with Alabama every year. Dabo had to battle with Alabama to win those national championships, and he did just fine. Speaking of top coaches, Pro Football Focus put out a list. Top 10 coaches in the NFL. Now, Pro Football Focus, I like them. I don't believe everything they put out. I don't take it as gospel, but I think it's a good resource for a lot of things, especially if you talk about like offensive linemen and the rankings there. They put out top 10 coaches. Now, Pro Football Focus is very analytical. So I don't know if there's some sort of analytical study that got them to this top 10 list. Number one, Bill Belichick. I would hope so. We can all agree there. Number two, they have John Harbaugh, second best coach in the NFL. And this is for, 2022. Again, I don't know if they're power ranking the coaches for this year or looking back at past success. Number three, they have Andy Reid. All right, solid top three. I'm not going to nitpick there. If you want to put Reid ahead of Harbaugh, all right, fine. I think those are probably the top three coaches based off of track record. Then you get to number four. Pro Football Focus has Cliff Kingsbury as the fourth best coach in the NFL. Why? His teams fall apart in the second half every year going back to college, and he has never won a playoff game. How is he the fourth best coach in the league? Pete Carroll's number five. If we're going off of resume, he should be in the top 10. Five, yeah, maybe. But he should be at least in the conversation. If we're trying to predict future outcome, yeah, obviously not top five. They're going to struggle. Matt LaFleur is six. He's had a lot of success. He's setting records, so hard to argue. Skeptics would say, well, he has Aaron Rodgers. Kyle Shanahan, 7. Mike Vrabel, 8. Frank Reich, 9. Mike McCarthy, 10. Reich in the top 10, and I'm a big Frank Reich guy, but I think he's a little unproven. He hasn't won a playoff game yet either, right? And Mike McCarthy, 10. I don't think he's even going to be employed in the next 12 months. Meanwhile, no Mike Tomlin's the first one that comes to mind. Oh, no Sean McVay, who has already been in two Super Bowls and just won one. I'm trying to think off the top of my head, obvious omissions. But Belichick, Harbaugh, Reed, top three. Then you get to Cliff Kingsbury, four. Frank Reich and Mike McCarthy, top 10. No Tomlin or Sean McVay. Trent, what do you think of Pro Football Focus's top 10 list of the 10 best coaches in the NFL?
Well, I think, first of all, it's disrespectful to Mike Tomlin, who's never had a losing season as a Steelers head coach. I mean, he's a Super Bowl champion. That's absolutely asinine. And second of all, there's a coach, like you mentioned, Sean McVay, who just won a Super Bowl and has, you know, created one of the more prolific offenses we've seen in the NFL in the past couple of years. So, yeah, I don't know what's going on over there at PFF. I know Chris Collinsworth, I believe, owns and runs it. Yeah, maybe we need to look at some of the talent that's putting these together, because that's absolutely ridiculous. You agree, right, with Mike Tomlin? That's the first name that came to mind when I saw this. Obviously, Sean McVay, but Mike Tomlin never had a losing seat. You're going to put that over Mike McCarthy? I am baffled right now.
Yeah, no, I agree. Tomlin is the first one. McVay should be there, too. It's remarkable. I mean, we've probably become numb to the point that people don't realize how crazy it is. Tomlin's been a head coach for 15 years. It's not like he just got the job. 15 years without ever having a losing season in a sport that is the most unpredictable, that is the most parity, that every year we have a team go from first to worst and worst to first. 15 years, he's never had a losing season. Now, I know he had Ben Roethlisberger, right? That helps. But Roethlisberger these last couple of years, not the same guy. There was plenty of times where Roethlisberger was injured. Michael Vick was starting games at one point. Has never had a losing season. It's remarkable. And I would even go so far, and I know this may be a hot take, it's a little bold, because of that fact and the consistency, and he has a Super Bowl, I may even put Tomlin number two.
Wow,
because
really?
You tell me, Andy Reid's only won one Super Bowl. Tomlin has one Super Bowl, and Tomlin's been more consistent. Has Andy Reid gone 15 years without a losing season? I don't think so. Now, you could tell me Reid had, you know, until Patrick Mahomes, lesser quarterbacks. But Andy Reid was a historic choker's too strong of a word. I used that earlier at Kirby. It's not the right term. Just a coach that came up short oftentimes in the playoffs. And Andy Reid is also notoriously bad with timeouts and game management. Great offensive coach, not good on the in-game decisions. But I was thinking about that. I don't know. Like Belichick, just like college football, Saban is the clear number one. I think Dabo's still certainly number two, but people evidently will debate it. In the NFL, Belichick clearly number one. He's the greatest coach of all time. And then who's number two? Like even Harbaugh, he only has one Super Bowl championship, and he's had a few losing seasons. And him and Tomlin are in the same division. I don't know what the record is head-to-head. They were both hired the same year. Same number of playoff. Harbaugh's got a couple more playoff wins, actually. But similar playoff records. Both have one Super Bowl, both in the same divisions. Tomlin has a better winning percentage overall. I don't know. Who would you say is the second best coach in the NFL?
It's hard not to either say, like you said, Mike Tomlin, Andy Reid comes to mind. But personally, Luke, if we're talking right now, Sean McVay's got to be in that conversation. I feel like the way he's kind of turned around the Rams organization as the head coach, being so young, his creative offenses, you have to throw him in that conversation, I feel like, as at least a top five coach. I mean, if we're really talking about this, I think Kyle Shanahan as well. I mean, they've been deep playoff runs basically every single year outside of one that he's been the head coach of the 49ers. I think you have to put all those guys into consideration right now.
Yeah, McVay, certainly, if we're talking right now. He, too, has never had a losing season. Now, granted, it's been 5 years.
Right.
But he's always had success right from the jump. Two Super Bowl appearances in 5 years total. Just won the Super Bowl. So he doesn't have as long of a resume or track record as some of those other coaches. But, yes, if we're power ranking for the immediate future, coaches, McVay, absolutely. Certainly, even in this list, probably should be top five. And you can make a case that second best coach would be McVay.
I think also Mike Vrabel needs to be a tad bit. I know his success hasn't been there, but I mean, think about last year. They had, what, 90 players in total come through the active roster and still finish first in the AFC. Coach of the year, I think he could be in the conversation for a top five coach right now.
Vrabel is very underrated.
Yes.
Now, his teams haven't done well enough in the playoffs, but he does have Ryan Tannehill. So I think that's why people downgrade him. But same idea, 4 years as a head coach, has had four winning seasons. He's won the division the last 2 years, and he is doing it with Ryan Tannehill. And as Trent said, a lot of injuries. They led the league in injuries this past year, and they still won 12 games. Now, in the playoffs, they've only won a playoff game once in the 4 years. That's where they're, you know, a little, that's why they're slack. That's why they just drafted a quarterback. Tannehill's not really the guy. But yeah, I think Vrabel's done a really good job. People don't pay attention to him. Last couple names that I want to get your take on. Frank Reich in the top 10.
I do not agree with that. I know you're a big Frank Reich guy and a Colts guy. I understand that, but I am not high on Frank Reich whatsoever, especially the way, and you can put a lot of the blame on Carson Wentz and his quarterback play last year for the downgrade of the Colts, but man, I haven't seen enough from Frank Reich to think that he's a top 10 coach over Mike Tomlin right now. I mean, that's
true.
That's ridiculous.
It's true.
And Sean McVay.
Yeah, Tomlin should be ahead of, obviously, almost all these guys. And then Mike McCarthy, number 10.
Yeah, maybe I'm a little, I'm not too fond of Mike McCarthy, especially the way the Packers ended his career. But no, I think that first year, yes, you lost Dak Prescott. The Cowboys have been a disappointment. I know they've been to the playoffs, but every single year they've been a disappointment with him at the helm of the franchise. So no, I don't think he's a top 10 coach right now.
No, I agree. I don't think he'll be even a coach a year from now.
Sean Payton's eyeing that job right now.
Yeah, now there's another question. We must just be talking active coaches, right? Because
right?
Sean Payton obviously is one. If you're talking, he just left the game, obviously. But if Sean Payton was still employed, he would have to be on the top 10 list. But I guess we are talking active coaches, so now you talk Dennis Allen in New Orleans. So we could exclude Sean Payton. But yeah, Mike Tomlin and McVay out of the top 10 seems bold. Kyle Brandt called it the worst list he's ever seen. That may be hyperbolic, but it's not a great list by Pro Football Focus. And I like those guys over there. We have them on the show all the time. All right, we have to take a timeout. We've gone way too long here in the first hour. More Midday Show on ESPN Radio.
Spend lunch with Luke.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
On the Morrow Midday Show.
The sound of your own wheels drive you crazy. Lighten up while you still can. Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand. And take it easy. Well, I'm standing on a corner in Winslow, Arizona.
It's the Morrow Midday Show with Luke Morrow. Here on ESPN Radio. We were talking about that list of top 10 NFL coaches last segment put out by Pro Football Focus. Now, Trent, you asked a good question during the commercial break. But a year from now, where could we see the most change? So let me ask you. I'll put you on the spot. You asked a great question. Which coach could you see over the next, say, 12 months suffering the biggest drop to their stock? And then the opposite. Who do you think 12 months from now will be looking at and say, actually, this guy, he may be a better coach than we thought. Who's going to help themselves out the most and who's going to hurt themselves this season alone?
I think it's tough to not say Mike McDaniel down in Miami, the way that they've constructed that roster. The big question, obviously, is their quarterback, Tua. Can he get these weapons the ball? Now, like you mentioned, Ryan Tannehill and a couple other quarterbacks that are kind of mediocre. I would put Tua in that mediocre kind of category. But he has weapons around him. Mike Vrabel looks amazing because Ryan Tannehill, yeah, as mediocre as he is, he had A.J. Brown catching balls and, you know, one of the best running backs in NFL history, that being Derrick Henry, in the backfield. Mike McDaniel has those weapons down in Miami, so I think he could potentially take a massive jump. Now, obviously, the AFC is an incredibly tough division. Going to be hard to beat the Bills. Going to be hard to beat the Patriots, even though Miami has the Patriots number. As far as falling goes, if Trey Lance starts for the 49ers this season, I could see Kyle Shanahan taking a significant dip out of that top 10 because personally, and I don't want to harp on Trey Lance, I've been doing a lot this week for some reason, but I don't see him as a true NFL starter as of right now. He's lucky that he has the amount of talent around him to be able to be successful, but we saw him in a couple games last year. I wasn't super hyped about him. Maybe he can make a jump in a year or two, but they're throwing him in immediately, so we'll have to see. But I think if the success of Trey Lance doesn't go the way that it should, Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch aren't going to look great trading 3 first-round picks away just to get Trey Lance when you got a quarterback in Jimmy Garoppolo who has led you to the playoffs and a Super Bowl on numerous occasions.
I like that thought about Shanahan and the Niners because, yes, I'm not a big Trey Lance guy either. I think the Niners will take a step back if they go with Trey Lance. And I like Kyle Shanahan.
Yeah.
And he's a good, obviously a good offensive coach, but he does have a losing record in San Francisco. Now, I know he's been to two NFC titles, so it's been, you know, boom or bust. But overall, losing record, he's only had two winning seasons in 5 years. And when Jimmy Garoppolo is not the starting quarterback, he's won something like a 30% of his games. The Niners have been terrible without Garoppolo. So, yes, if they go with Trey Lance and they have, say, a 500 season, maybe a losing season, now you're looking at like, well, hold on. You've been here 6 years. We've only had two winning years. Shanahan's one of those guys that he, I don't know, if I were to compare him to somebody, almost maybe like a Kyrie Irving in the NBA, and I love Kyrie, but where, or maybe Jason Tatum, who I've been tough on, because everyone's saying he's a superstar. I don't see it, at least not yet. Where you get wrapped up in the potential or like the capabilities. You see what Shanahan and the Niners are capable of, but it doesn't happen enough. You've had two winning seasons in 5 years, but when you have a winning season, you go all the way to the NFC title game. Deebo Samuel's having a great year. You could see that potential is there. But at a certain point, you got to show me enough. Now, I'm not telling you that Shanahan should be fired, but that's why coaches lose. You could hire the most impressive, talented coach, but if he's not winning enough games, at a certain point, he's going to lose his job. Kyrie's another where we talk about, and I really do believe Kyrie is one of the best point guards we've ever seen. He's probably the best scorer for his size. But everywhere he goes, right, it's an issue. They're not winning. And he's creating problems, and at a certain point, it's not matching what you expect from him or what he's capable of doing with the actual output you're getting. And for Shanahan, if you have a bad year this year, you see what he's what the potential is, what he's capable of, and how talented he may be. But it's like, man, looking at the back of your baseball card here, you don't have a great record in San Francisco, which is odd because they've been in two of the last three NFC title games.
Yeah, we hold them in such a high regard because of their success. And without Jimmy Garoppolo, like you said, they struggle mightily. Now, a name that wasn't on that list, or it might have been, and I missed it, Brandon Staley out for the Los Angeles Chargers. He also might be able to make a massive leap because of how good that defense looks right now. And they have all the weapons around them. But first 2 years, two missed playoff opportunities with a generational quarterback in Justin Herbert. He's a, you know, analytics guru, and it's sometimes to his fault. So we'll have to see. But he could also make a jump in the top 10 if they do make the playoffs and have a good run.
That's another good candidate. I would say no just because I'm not a Staley guy. But, yeah, I mean, they have one of the most talented rosters. I would say Sean McDermott's another, right, in Buffalo. If the Bills, I mean, they are, what, Super Bowl favorites?
Yeah, right? They are. Plus, they, and by far, Super Bowl favorites. Tampa Bay's plus 800. Buffalo's plus 650 right now.
Yeah, so I think that's another one. And then I look at, if we're going off this top 10 list of Pro Football Focus, let me tell you, there's this young whippersnapper named Sean McVay, who you may be haven't heard of, but a year from now, you may be talking about him as a top 10 coach. And if we're going off this top 10 list from Pro Football Focus that we've been analyzing here this afternoon, the obvious one to fall out would probably be Mike McCarthy, who's number 10 on this list. And again, I'll reiterate, I probably won't have that job a year from now. So that'll be the obvious one just based off of this list. A coach that right now is, at least by somebody, considered top 10, that I think will fall out of the top 10. Hey, coming up, I actually meant to get to it there, but then Trent asked a great question in the commercial break, and I said, oh, that's fascinating. We'll get to quarterbacks coming up in college football, because every year the hype is always around a quarterback or two, and they're never the ones that are drafted first. Who is that sleeper in college football this year at the quarterback position? And one of those potential sleepers has a really odd habit that may keep me from wanting them on my team. We'll get to that coming up. Plus, LIV Golf Tour getting off and rolling, and punishments handed down for the golfers that left the tour. We'll get to that as well. Plenty more to do. Hour 2 coming up next. It's the Mara Midday Show on ESPN Radio.